Welcome to Your Cases on Hold, a JBJS podcast hosted by Antonia Chen and Andrew Schoenfeld.
Here, we discuss the science of each issue of JBJS with an additional dose of entertainment and pop culture.
Take us with you in the gym, on the commute, or most certainly, whenever your case is on hold.
Welcome back to another episode of Your Case is on Hold, episode number 80. You've been with us for a long time. We appreciate it. If you're dialing in for the first time, thanks for joining us. We think you're going to have a great time listening to us talk about some of the articles in JBJS. This is for April 16th. And I am Antonia Chen, Deputy Editor of Adult Reconstruction. And we have here...
I am Andrew Schoenfeld, Deputy Editor for Methods, and I was hired by the Knudsens.
Oh, that's nice. I like that addition.
Yeah.
So, as you can see, the opinions are of our own. They don't belong to anyone else, and they're 100% not representative of the board of JBJS or anyone else at JBJS. This is brought to you by the Miller Review Course. If you have not attended the Miller Review Course and you were in that season where you're doing boards, that is an excellent course to go to, get lots of learning, and is a fantastic way to get all your distilled information in one spot. So without further ado, let's jump into top of the pile. We have a lot in top of the pile, a lot of interesting information. What's New in Sports Medicine by Fredrickson et al., and it's permanently free. There's an article on Ramon Gustilo, MD, by Schmidt, and it's also permanently free. So learn about the greats in orthopedics. From Policy to Practice, Challenges in Implementing PROMS Reporting Under the New CMS Mandate by Huffman. The Bone Question by Sheldon, which is permanently free, so you have no excuse not to read that. On What's Important, Fertility Preservation During Orthopedic Residency. As more and more programs are paying for fertility preservation, it's interesting to learn about this. Fisher writes a nice piece on this, and it's also permanently free. What are the economic incentives in orthopedic surgery? A primer by Magruder. Evaluating the performance of artificial intelligence for improving readability of online English and Spanish language orthopedic patient educational material. Challenges in Bridging the Digital Divide by Reaver. There's accuracy and precision of anatomical medial patellofemoral ligament identification using the CLASS MRI method, a cadaveric study by Thurig. Outcomes of autogenous bone graft for periprosthetic osteolysis after total ankle arthroplasty, clinical and three-dimensional computed tomography results by Yoon. Patient-reported outcomes of pain and related quality of life 1 year after bone-anchored limb implantation in patients with lower limb amputation by Shaw. Rates of osteonecrosis after femoral lengthening with intramedullary lengthening nails by Dubin. Admission, neutrophil to lymphocyte ratio is superior to white blood cell count at predicting the presence and severity of pediatric musculoskeletal infection by Ho. Comparison of adductor canal block before versus after total knee arthroplasty in terms of stress, pain, and functional outcome, a double-blinded randomized controlled trial by Wang, which is 30 days free. The Peng block, an elective primary anterior total hip arthroplasty associated with reduced length of stay, a multidisciplinary prospective randomized double-blind controlled trial by Hanauer et al., and it's permanently free. And finally, before our headlines, association between surgeon volume and patient outcomes after elective patellofemoral arthroplasty, a population-based cohort study using data from the National Joint Registry and Hospital Episode Statistics for England by Vela Baldacchino et al., and it's permanently free.
Cue the outro music. That's about all the time we have this week.
Done. There's a lot of really interesting articles. So
it was just like last time.
Definitely worth your reading. We still have our headlines and we still have our honorable mentions. So for our headlines, please tell us about computer-assisted virtual preoperative planning for the treatment of pilon fractures, a retrospective propensity score match study by G et al., and this is permanently free.
You skipped There Is a Fracture, a haiku by C. Zachary Chadson.
There's a fracture.
That's a different issue of JBJS some other time.
I love it.
All right. So this is obviously a retrospective study conducted between 2010 and 2019 among 611 patients with a pilon fracture. And obviously, in some of these patients, they're using computer-assisted virtual preoperative planning, and in others, they're not. So the question, you know, you see this sometimes when they put them head-to-head, maybe you see no difference, and the conclusion would be, well, there's no difference. You get the same outcomes, but then you're ignoring the confounding by indication. And that is the issue here. So there's the selection bias and obviously potentially more severe preoperative planning. More severe fractures require virtual preoperative planning, computer assistance, while simpler ones maybe do not. So what they wanted to do is a causal inference test, a propensity score matching, matching patients who receive computer-assisted preoperative planning with those who did not. And basically, they developed their propensity scores using predicted probabilities after adjusting for potential confounders identified in the directed acyclic graph, which they present as an appendix, visually representing the relationships between variables. So a little bit more agnostic as far as things go. Some of that is going to be based on the performance of those variables with the study power, but they did have, you know, reasonable numbers, obviously over 600 patients. They did a one-to-one ratio, but they used a caliper of 0.25. That is the one false note in an otherwise study that's conducted, you know, quite well. A caliper of 0.2 is considered permissive. 0.25, that's somewhat beyond the pale, I would say. We like to see ideally calipers of 0.1. And we've discussed this before. It's like, are you matching paintings? Are you matching masters? Are you matching a crayon, Crayola crayon drawing with the Mona Lisa, right? Like they all could be matched together, but you know, the integrity of these kinds of studies really depend on the precision of the match. And that's a very, very permissive caliper that they're using. They also use 20 baseline characteristics in the propensity score, which is a lot. And again, they did it in an agnostic way, which you get into the same kind of problems that you do with overfit regression models. And there's not a lot of clarity around what exactly and how and in which way those were used. But if we just sort of take it at face value, which is, you know, they match these cohorts and the patients who received computer-assisted preoperative planning, they had a better mean OMAS score at 12 months with a difference of 7.1, where the MCID is 6. So they're like 1 point beyond the MCID. Then some of their secondary outcomes also had significant differences. Lower rate of soft tissue complications. Their conclusion is that patients with a pilon fracture, computer-assisted preoperative planning yields better functional and radiographic outcomes at a low rate of soft tissue complications. I mean, I think it probably obviously depends on the severity of the fracture. It's not any pilon fracture. You know, simple, non-comminuted, good articular surfaces. You probably don't need the computer-assisted. But of a certain severity, I think it makes intuitive sense that computer-assisted reconstruction is going to be advantageous. So nothing really to put on hold here. The one real like I wish you would have done it differently is that caliper is as high as it is, and we don't have excellent visibility on the parameters that are sort of amalgamated in the propensity score. But at the end of the day, I mean, it makes sense what they're saying. Like this is the outcome you would expect.
Thank you, methodology man.
All right, that's my alter ego.
I like it, methodology man. I'm going to call you that now. Total hip arthroplasty in children, a Dutch arthroplasty register study with data from 283 hips, very specific number. Van Kujawijk et al., there's an infographic and it's permanently free. So when I was a resident, this is what I wanted to do for a living. I loved total hip arthroplasty. I love total knee arthroplasty. I love joint arthroplasty. And I also love working with children. So I thought it'd be a great job option to do. That said, in this study, there were 283 hips. Between the ages, and these were patients between the ages of 11 and 18, and it was performed over 15 years, 2007 to 2022. So the short answer is probably not a good profession if I want to have some sort of volume over time, but at least the thought was there. So I wouldn't be busy enough as an arthroplasty surgeon, but this study does look at this, and it is interesting to look at these patients who received total hip arthroplasty, and they were for non-oncologic reasons. there were previous studies done in this patient population with only 24 patients with limited follow-up. So this is really looking at a larger cohort of patients. And they used the Dutch Arthroplasty Register, and they looked at 5 to 10 year implant survivorship using Kaplan-Meier survivorship analysis, risk factors for revision, and results of patient-reported outcomes. And they looked at this comparing preoperatively to 3 and 6 months postoperatively. Interestingly enough, if you look at adults, the percentage of people undergoing a total hip replacement probably a little bit more female, but here 57% of the patient population was female and the mean age at the time of surgery was 16. The most common indications were osteosarcosis, dysplasia, and osteoarthritis. Less prevalent were inflammatory arthritis, late post-traumatic indications, SCIFI, neuromuscular disorders, and fracture. There was a group of other that included rare disorders such as Stickler syndrome and Marfan syndrome undergoing total hip arthroplasty, but it was really the common culprits such as osteonecrosis, for example, of getting previous cancer treatments or high-dose steroids. In the majority of the total hip procedures, 77% of them, a posterior lateral approach was used. Now, this is just something interesting for me as a surgeon and for anyone who does arthroplasty. What do you do in these young patients? So in the Dutch registry, 49% were uncemented, 38% were cemented, 11% were reverse hybrid, meaning they cemented the acetabulum and not the stem, and then hybrid was 2%, which is interesting. And that's probably not what I would see in the American population. But in terms of fixation principles in our younger patients, that's something that always becomes a question. The mean articulation types were ceramic on polyethylene for 42% of it and metal on polyethylene for 41% of it. So very little ceramic on ceramic, which some people will advocate in our younger patients. So the problem in this study of 283 hips, 49 of them didn't have sufficient follow-up. So there's 234 hips eligible for survival analysis. The median follow-up was 7 years with a range of 2 to 16 years. 6% or only 14 of the hips were revised in this time frame. And that's probably pretty standard because polyethylene will probably take 20 to 25 years to wear out. And I do warn these younger patients that there will be a time frame where they will likely have to have a revision because their plastic or polyethylene will wear out. So 7 years is still a little early for that. So seeing 14 of them revised is not that surprising. 12 of them underwent partial revision. One underwent a girdle stone procedure and one was other, which was unspecified. There was aseptic loosening on the acetabular cup, infection, aseptic loosening of the femoral stem, and again, some of these other unspecified ones. The 5-year cumulative implant survival rate was 95% and the 10-year survival rate was 91%. There was an insufficient number of events to allow for statistical analysis for potential risk factors for revision. So 14 just wasn't enough to really deep dive into this. Now, they did have PROMS data, but they had it for 7% of patients for the Oxford Hip score at 12 months and 20% for the EQ5D quality of life test as well. That said, the authors did conclude that all PROMS had improved significantly at 12 months postoperatively versus preoperatively, but the numbers are really tiny. So the numbers are small when it comes to PROMS. This data set is interesting to know this information. It's good to shed some light on young total hip replacements. I would vote for more collaborative research across multiple different countries, multiple different registries, et cetera, to really understand this patient population better because people have different regional biases. There's different patient populations. I'd love to be able to see this compared in a bigger cohort. This is obviously one of the bigger cohorts available for this young patient population, but I would love to see even more to understand this population better and to understand what the risk factors are for failure so that we hopefully don't repeat this in our young patient population.
Yeah, it seems like a real opportunity for, you know, international collaboration to get a larger cohort of patients with a more representative sample. As it stands right now, it's just a rote clinical retrospective of the center experience with these procedures. Interesting, but you know, maybe more for edification than application.
I like that. Edification instead of application. Well done. All right. So we're going to the Your Case is on Hold featurette. We're going on a different pathway with total hips. We are doing total hips still, but we're going to do it in the adult population. And so this is an article out of Mayo Clinic that says weight loss before total hip arthroplasty was not associated with decreased postoperative risk factors. This is by Seward et al. And a shout out to Mike Seward, who is a med student that I worked with in the past. And he's continuing on his wonderful pathway of looking at weight loss. especially as it's associated with total joint arthroplasty.
Is he a resident now?
He's a resident at Mayo right now.
Oh, okay.
So there's a commentary on this. So many arthroplasty surgeons do use BMI cutoffs when offering total hip arthroplasty, and typically the cutoff is 40 because there's some older retrospective studies that show increased complications of greater than 40 and decreased complication of under 40. But it is kind of an arbitrary number. But there is very little known about patients who lose weight before total hip, if weight loss actually improves outcomes. So this study evaluated how many patients actually lost weight before primary total hip. It identified predictors of preoperative weight loss and evaluated whether preoperative weight loss was associated with improved outcomes. The study included 53,000 patients who underwent surgery between 2002 and 2019, but it was really limited to 2,463 patients who had a BMI of greater than 30 kilograms per meter squared, which I find that number actually much smaller than I anticipated percentage-wise in Minnesota, but that was something that I didn't expect. And this was weight measured 1 to 24 months prior to surgery. And they also had their weight measured at the time of surgery. They excluded patients who lacked weight measurement at the time of surgery or lacked weight measurement prior to surgery, after surgery, who were less than 18 years of age and had a second total hip or total knee during the study period because you couldn't tell the weight loss and the outcomes if something else had undergone during that time frame. The mean age was 66 years old and 47% were women. The mean BMI was 35 kilograms per meter square. And prior to 2 years of follow-up, 47 hips were revised and 56 patients died. An additional 206 patients had less than 2 years of follow-up. And the mean follow-up for the remaining 2,154 hips was 5 years of the range from 2 to 19 years. So the results showed that before total hip replacement, of these patients, remember, who had BMI of 30 or greater, 45% of the patients lost weight, 38% maintained their weight loss, and 17% actually gained greater than 5 pounds. Overall, 16% lost 5 to less than 10 pounds, 17% lost 10 to 20%, less than 20 pounds, and 12% of them lost greater than or equal to 20 pounds prior to surgery. 32% of the patients had a weight change of greater than 5% of their body weight by the day of surgery. 7% of them actually gained weight, while 25% of them lost weight. The mean weight change was approximately 6 pounds. The range was minus 188 pounds to gaining 75 pounds, which is a pretty big range. And among the patients who lost weight before total hip replacement, the mean weight change was approximately 13 pounds with a range of 0.2 loss to minus, again, that minus 188 pounds. So 28% of patients with a preoperative BMI of greater than 40 achieved a BMI of less than 40 by the time of surgery. And the authors do note that the word only is placed before this. It required a mean of 1.3 years to lose the weight with a range of 0.1 to 2 years, which is a pretty long time. The mean decrease in BMI for those patients was 51 kilograms per meter squared. And among those patients, 82% achieved this weight loss without bariatric surgery and had a mean decrease in BMI of 3.8 kilograms per meter squared. For the 18% who did have bariatric surgery, they had a mean decrease in BMI of 11 kilograms per meter squared. What were factors that were not associated with preoperative weight change? Sex, tobacco use, and Charleston comorbidity index. So no comorbidity association. What factors were associated with preoperative weight change? ASA group. There were significant but weak negative correlations between weight change in age and surgery year and initial BMI. The 10-year survivorship free for any reoperation for the overall cohort was 95%. And when doing multivariable analysis, there were no significant improvements in operative time, length of stay, discharge disposition, or survivorship free of PJI, complications, revision, or reoperation for any weight loss category when compared to those who maintain their weight. So while we ask patients to lose weight prior to surgery, and our reasoning is increased infection rate, increased complications, decreased survival, things like that, in this total hip population at the Mayo Clinic, they found that preoperative weight loss was not associated with a decreased risk of postoperative complications, revisions, or reoperations, even with those patients with significant weight loss greater than 20 pounds. Now, there are benefits to losing weight for your overall health for other ways, depending on how you lose it, hopefully not in a crash diet way. But if you lose in a healthy manner, it can help with your cardiovascular status and your health in other areas. But in this study, it really, they try to call into question whether or not you need to do preoperative weight loss alone prior to surgery as being enough to reduce the risk of complications in patients after undergoing elective total hip arthroplasty.
Do you know what's like the seminal article that made that cut point at 40, over 40, less than 40 for doing joint replacement?
So it's a good question. The only article that I could find back in the day, and we're talking like 1988, was in Total Knee Arthroplasty. And it was probably JBJS actually.
Yeah, most likely.
Right, small series of patient. If BMI under 40, 22% complications, and above 40 was 2% complications. And not that people...
The other way around, I think you mean.
I'm sorry, you're right. BMI under 40, 2% complications, over 40 was 22% complications. And I don't know if that's the seminal article, but it's the one earliest one that I could find where it was an arthroplasty saying maybe 40 should be our cutoff. And there's been so many studies in between saying 35, 45, 50, 60, all these... basically arbitrary cutoffs that people have used. And 40 seems to be the magic number.
There are a few things here that I would point out. Some of it just sort of pointers for the erstwhile reader and researcher, and then some of it a little bit more intrinsic to the message or their conclusion. So the first thing is that they say that covariates were identified based on their availability in our total joint registry. And in the following sentence says, CCI and history of bariatric surgery were included based on their clinical relevance to weight loss. I don't understand, presumably those were also available in their registry, otherwise they wouldn't have access to them. And they go on later to say, multivariable analyses were adjusted for age, sex, CCI, surgery, year, and history of prior bariatric surgery. So that the first sentence about including covariates based on what was available in the total joint registry probably can be removed because it goes without saying. Now, they do this layered regression analysis where they do they're calling it univariable. It's actually bivariate, but that's semantics. Anyway, they're doing like a head-to-head comparison initially, and then they do the multivariable analysis. Unclear why they're doing that exactly. They don't say why they're doing it. And in general, if you have the multivariable analysis, that's going to supersede anything else. So it doesn't really matter unless you're using the bivariate to identify risk factors, which is not a best practice. So there's some opacity here about the way they went about certain things. At the end of the day, the most important thing that I think that they're missing here is those patients who lost weight and then had surgery, or those patients who didn't yet still had surgery, those are not the counterfactual of each other. Those are not viable counterfactuals. You don't know about the patient who was told we're not doing the surgery for you unless you lose weight for, you know, the holistic 360. BMI is, it's one number, but I think a lot of these determinations are made in the context of the patient. We do it for spine too. Like BMI is a factor among many. Just like in college admissions, your SAT score, it's not you get a 1600, you can go to whatever school you want. Plenty of people get rejected when they have a 1600 on their SAT. So there's more to it than just, it's not just the BMI. It's, you know, is the patient diabetic? What's their hemoglobin A1C? What's their blood sugar control? What are their other medical comorbidities? Now they're accounting for comorbidities, but they're doing it in what I would consider in this context, a pretty crude way, because they're just doing CCI, right? So CCI is basically three comorbidities is three comorbidities, but if two of those comorbidities are like well-controlled high blood pressure, and I don't know, you know, pick something out of the box, like ankylosing spondylitis, right? That's very different from poorly controlled diabetes and HIV or hepatitis, cirrhosis. Big difference. They're going to have the same CCI score, but those are very big differences, especially when you then also factor in a very high BMI. So the problem here is that these were patients who were selected for surgery. You don't know anything about the patients who weren't picked for surgery. Now, what you would hope and what I believe to be true is that at a place like a Mayo Clinic or, you know, any other very well-experienced, high-volume tertiary center, those individuals are good at what they do and they're good at selecting patients who are going to have good outcomes. You obviously don't want to select patients who have bad outcomes. So when they pick somebody over 40 BMI to do the surgery on, they have basically made the assessment and they said, you know what, you don't need to lose weight for whatever reason. We're going to do this at this BMI. It's a safe, the risk-based analysis. We're confident that we're going to have a good outcome for you. And lo and behold, they all tend to end up at the same outcome, which is what you would expect. You don't want, right? So because you don't have the counterfactual, but you don't have the version of the people who didn't lose weight and yet you still did the operation when you told them to, versus those that you said you don't need to lose weight and we're going to do the operation. It's very hard. It's not an apples to apples comparison. And this is really one of those where I think that the maxim, absence of evidence is not evidence of absence, does apply.
That was confusing. Say that one more time. The absence of
absence of evidence is not evidence of absence, meaning that because you didn't find a difference doesn't mean that there isn't actually a difference in those parameters.
Very good point. Very deep.
I agree. We should do holistic assessment. Holistic assessment of patients.
Agreed.
Not just make determinations based on one characteristic.
Sure. I agree. And that's a big thing. And there are probably patient optimization in all sorts of other ways, right? So
yeah, of course.
And these are surgeons who probably do different fixation methods based on different patients and different things like that. And so that's not taking all these things into account. All right. Moving on to honorable mentions. The effect of computer navigation and patient-specific instrumentation on risk of revision, PROMs, and mortality following total knee arthroplasty, an analysis of the National Joint Registry data by Farhan Alaini et al. With a commentary and a visual summary. This is an observational study using the National Joint Registry from the UK that found that navigation, computer navigation, and patient-specific instrumentation had no statistically or clinically meaningful effect on the risk of revision measured by implant survival, patient-reported outcomes measured by the Oxford Knee Score and health-related quality of life, or the EQ-5D, or mortality following primary total knee arthroplasty. The clinical functional sports participation and osteoarthritis outcomes after ACL injury, a 10-year follow-up study of the Delaware Oslo ACL cohort treatment algorithm by Johansson et al. This is nice in that the 10-year follow-up study. These participants who were following up in this initial study, they received a certain treatment algorithm after ACL injury. There's also a patient who got progressive rehabilitation alone, and this patient who underwent early ACL reconstruction, and then patients who went delayed ACL reconstruction. They found that patients who followed a certain treatment algorithm using this Delaware Oslo ACL cohort after ACL injury without surgery had high percentages of satisfaction and symmetrical quad strength and hop performance, high sports participation rates, and low prevalences of osteoarthritis. For the patients who had ACL tears and chose progressive rehabilitation alone, despite being older and less active, they had similar clinical, functional, sports participation, and osteoarthritis outcome scores compared to those who chose early ACL reconstructions. For patients who underwent delayed ACL reconstruction, they had lower KOOS sports, KOOS quality of life, and HOP performance compared with both groups. And finally, sports participation is associated with superior 10-year patient acceptable symptom state achievement following contemporary hip arthroscopy for femoral acetabular impingement by Galat. This is looking at long-term follow-up. So again, 10 years, similar to the last study. 10-year follow-up after hip arthroscopy for femoral acetabular impingement. And it's really hard to see 10-year follow-up on these patients. So this study looked at athletes who underwent hip arthroscopy for femoral acetabular impingement, and they showed that these athletes had superior patient-reported outcomes and patient-acceptable symptom state achievement compared to non-athletes at 10-year follow-up. And athletes and non-athletes showed reoperation-free survival frequencies of 87.5% and 82.8% respectively. So participating in a sport is actually a good thing after getting these hip arthroscopies for femoral acetabular impingement. That's all we have today. Thank you so much for joining us, and we look forward to our next episode.